Our guest today, Crystal Zevon, has authored an extraordinary biography of her husband, Warren Zevon. It's an oral history with lovers, bandmates, friends, and family, plus a strong representation from the authors he loved to hang out with, like Carl Hiaasen and Mitch Albom, telling his life story. It's called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zevon, and it contains a lot of the seedy side of the life of an alcoholic rock star, but you also understand why Crystal and most others in the book loved him. Crystal and Warren met in 1971. She was his second wife and mother to his daughter, Ariel. Later on in the hour, we'll talk with Warren's son by his first wife, Jordan Zevon. I asked Crystal when she started working on the book. The answer wasn't that simple.
Actually, when we first got together in 1971, so we lived together for a few years before we were married. And before he even recorded the first Asylum record, we used to sit down together and write his biography. So it was something that was sort of in the hopper for a long time. But obviously, when we split up, I kind of dropped that notion. But when he was diagnosed, right after he was diagnosed, it came up again. And according to him, it was kind of a suggestion of Carl Hiaasen's that this would be the natural thing to do. Carl and Warren had sort of different versions of how that went, but there was talk between the two of them. And from that time on, he just kind of assumed that I was going to do it. So through the last year of his life, we would talk and he would, you know, remember incidents or episodes and you know, be sure to talk to so-and-so and, you know, those kinds of reminders. And then the week before he died, he called and said, so you're going to do this thing, right? I said, well, I guess so. And he said, well, you know, you got to tell the whole truth, even the awful ugly parts, because that's the excitable boy who wrote them excitable songs. And I said, Warren, I don't know if I know what the whole truth is. And he laughed. He said, you'll find out. So it was a tall order.
Were there times as you went along that you questioned your decision to do this?
Absolutely. Many times. I mean, there were a few times when I put it down and said, I can't. This is too much, too hard. But I don't think until I was really finished with it that it hit me full on how this not only exposed the excitable boy, but all the people who were close to him.
Mm-hmm.
Including, you know, the family. And how could I put that out there? And yet, one thing Warren knew about me is if I made a promise, I'd do it. So I did.
We should actually make it clear, because I didn't actually at the beginning, that the book is in the form with Crystal's interjections of an oral history, with everybody telling their story of Warren in their own words. Did you find out things that were completely surprising to you? Do you find out things you did not know at all?
That's a question that comes up a lot. And the truth is, I used to sort of think, well, this was surprising. You know, some of the excesses, some of the, you know, I didn't know all the details of his life. We weren't together for a long time, even though we talked often. But the truth is, what surprised me most was that in the final analysis, no, nothing surprised me that much. Hmm. I mean, there was nothing it might have been more extreme, or he might have suffered more than I was aware of. But no, I knew him. Right. And I guess that's why he asked me to do it.
Did you know about the diaries?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. We started that when we first got together. The two of us, we each had a diary by the side of our beds, you know, with those promises, like, we'll never look at each other's diary, which, of course, we did and regretted it. But no, he kept those always. And I don't think a lot of people knew, but I was somebody who knew that he kept them. And they detailed everything from what kind of sandwich he had to, how many times he brushed his teeth that day.
Which he probably kept track of, because he's one of the things one finds out is the level of his OCD on many, many subjects. Is that something that was at the same level through most of his life?
Well, I think it was. We didn't know what OCD was, you know, back in the 70s when we were together. And, I would just think, oh, he's strange, or here comes another one of those things. I mean, I adjusted to things. Like, because he'd avoided the draft, he couldn't drive past a billboard with Uncle Sam. I think there's something about it in the book. And the first time that happened, we were late to an important meeting, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was something to do with his career. And we had to turn around the block and drive around it X number of times and then pass the billboard going the opposite direction to, you know, undo the spell. And, you know, I'd get angry. I'd say, what are we doing? This is crazy. We're late. I never considered not doing what he asked because it was extremely important to him. And when he found out about OCD, when it became something, you know, diagnosable, he was thrilled because it almost made him feel normal. You know, there were other people that had this. You know, like he and Billy Bob Thornton used to compare each other's OCD and who had it worse. And Warren won, by the way.
Warren had friendships with many authors. Any evidence that he himself wanted to extend his writing into fiction?
Oh, he definitely would have loved to do that. He tried. I mean, in the book, there's actually a little notebook from when we were in Spain where he started writing a detective story. His detective's name was Whip S. Bug. and you know, he loved those phrases like, her face exploded like a potato. you know, whatever that means. It's not what he did, but he certainly would have liked to. But my daughter inherited his books, and, you know, it's just floor-to-ceiling library in every room of her house, as it was in his.
The book describes the Santa Barbara meeting with Ross McDonald. Was that a particularly important one to him?
That may have been the most important one in some senses. I mean, Ross McDonald, during his first sobriety period with sobriety, and when he relapsed, Ross McDonald came over to our house and helped him empty the bottles of booze. I mean, he says Lou Archer arrived at my door, which was, for anyone who doesn't know, Ross McDonald's detective. No, that was enormous. We were both huge fans. When we were in Spain, we read every single Ross McDonald book. You know, we'd each have one going at the same time. And so when we came back and met Paul Nelson and he took us up to meet Ross McDonald, that was another one of those pinnacle moments. You know, Jonathan Kellerman, that was another one. He would either write fan letters to people or he would show up at their book signings and just say, hi, I'm Warren Zevon, and get to know them. You know, they'd become friends.
The book describes years of alcoholism and when he finally decided to get sober, years of sex addiction, compulsive behavior. What is your interpretation of what in his early life precipitated this behavior, these demons? And would he have agreed that it was something in his early life?
I think that Warren tried to take responsibility for his actions. I think he knew that he had demons that came from his early life. But I don't think he would blame those. Mm-hmm. I think he felt that wasn't a justification. And I think as, you know, in his later life, when he did get sober and then certainly when he was diagnosed, he tried to make sure that he reached out and made amends where he could. I think family became paramount in importance to him in his later life. You know, he started to prioritize his heroes. While he loved great art and believed he was one of the suffering artists, geniuses, if you will, and I say that he believed that with humility. But I think he also he looked up to Jorge Calderon, his partner and co-writer on many songs, and Carl Hiaasen and Jonathan Kellerman and people who had solid marriages who put their families first and still were able to create art. He didn't believe he could do that, but I think that's what he most admired.
So how have Ariel and Jordan and the rest of the family reacted to the book?
The Zevon family seemed to be, you know, excited and, you know, reacting to it fine. They I'm talking about the cousins and so on. Ariel has not read the whole book. I don't think Jordan has either, although he may have by now. And I think it's tough. This is their dad, and he was not an easy guy. But then they all made their peace with him and had, in the end, great relationships with him. Jordan, I think, has had a hard time with it. When I interviewed Jordan very early on, and he lost his mother about 6 months after he lost his dad. And I think it was very, very difficult for him to talk at all. And since the book's come out, I think he's wished he had said things that didn't make it into the book. I was trying to be sensitive to, you know, to his feelings at the time, because he was suffering greatly from the loss of both his parents. So it's been it's difficult.
We've all seen the film of the making of The Wind, and he became so determined to finish that. What are your memories of that period of time? Not particularly right before he died, but in the period when he was working on that.
Well, I was in Vermont, so our communication was by telephone. We talked several times a day for the first few months after his diagnosis, and then as he got into making The Wind, and, you know, he did relapse when he started drinking, we talked less. But then it picked up again towards the end. Our daughter got pregnant, and so we had all that to talk about. What he told me about The Wind was that he... let me back up a bit. When he was first diagnosed, he started considering going on a spiritual quest. You know, should I go to India and, you know, have my ashes scattered in the Ganges? He had a girlfriend who was Catholic. He thought about becoming Catholic, you know, to be able to confess his sins and be forgiven. I mean, he really, truly searched all these things out. And then in the end, he said, you know, what I do, what my spiritual connection to this life is I write music, I make songs. And so he wanted to leave a legacy in songs. He also really didn't have much of a career at the time that he was diagnosed, even though he had released, I mean, I think Life Will Kill You is one of his finest albums. I think, you know, it that should have gotten Grammys, in my opinion. But it didn't. And they were having a hard time even booking him in clubs. So I think he made a decision to basically market himself. He wanted to say goodbye to people with the songs he wrote. And he wanted to get his name back someplace. He wanted to leave something for his children and his grandchildren.
Yeah, in the end, do you have expectations of what people will take away from the book about Warren?
Well, you know, it's difficult because it tramples over a lot of troubled territory. And you know, what I tried to do was what he asked me to do, was to tell the truth. And it's not an easy or comfortable truth. But in the end, I think what I want to come through and what I hope comes through is that he did have that sort of spiritual awakening, as it were, before he died. He was there for the birth of his grandsons. He was consulting with his son Jordan about what to do with his music. He was talking to Jorge about, you know, how he wanted his music presented afterwards. Talking to me about, you know, how he felt like the truth needed to be told about what it took to write those songs. So you know, I hope that, yes, the awful, ugly parts are certainly in this book, but I hope in the long run, as I said in the acknowledgments, what makes me cry when I read the book or when I look at it when I remember Warren, is the picture at the end of him holding our twin grandsons, just who were born a couple months before he died, because that's really who he was.
Shadows are falling and I'm running out of breath. Keep me in your heart for a while. If I leave you, it doesn't mean mean I love you any less. Keep me in your heart for a while. When you get up in the morning and you see that crazy sun, keep me in your heart for a while. There's a train leaving nightly called when all is said and done. Keep me in your heart for a while. Sha-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Keep me in your heart for a while. Sha-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Keep me in your heart for a while. Sometimes when you're doing simple things around the house, maybe you'll think of me and smile. You know I'm tied to you like the buttons on your blouse. Keep me in your heart for a while. Hold me in your thoughts, take me to your dreams, touch me as I'm falling. Headed north to Pleasant Stream. Keep me in your heart for a while. These wheels keep turning, but they're running out of steam. Keep me in your heart for a while. Sha-la.
From the album The Wind, Warren Zevon, and Keep Me in Your Heart for a While. We talked with Crystal Zevon. She is his second wife and the author of the book, I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zevon. Jordan Zevon is the son of Warren Zevon and his first wife, Tool Livingston. He is a singer-songwriter in his own right and co-produced his father's final album, The Wind. He also produced Preludes, an album of demos and alternate versions of his father's work that Jordan found in suitcases in a Southern California storage facility. I remarked to Jordan that the last time I had seen him was on stage at the Grammys as he and Jorge Calderon picked up their awards for producing his father's final album, The Wind. I asked him about that moment.
Well, you know, the word bittersweet came up a lot, and I didn't feel a lot of the bitterness because at least he was acknowledged. So it was a very special moment, and I was really proud. I enjoyed the moment and just thought that it was great that Dad finally got some recognition for his songwriting.
Yeah, and he was he himself was pretty, when he realized the extent of the cancer, he was pretty intent at exploiting his, if you want to look at it that way, exploiting his death as much as possible.
Well, I think that that he just saw it as this is what he'd done his entire life. I mean, since he was a teenager, and I think that he wanted to be able to say his last words and put it all out there. I think that he knew that there'd be things like tribute records and maybe outtakes and things like that released, but at least he wanted to say his piece before he left.
Well, now comes these recordings, preludes, rare and unreleased recordings, some versions of some songs we know, song you may have known but never heard these versions of. What is the origin of these? I understand you were kind of responsible for finding these.
Yeah, there was a storage space of my father's in the valley out here in Los Angeles, and I'd been out there before and tried to kind of help him clean up the place. Dad was kind of a snake in the sense that he'd kind of shed his skin every couple of years and put a bunch of tour T-shirts and pictures and instruments and things like that and just put them in storage and start fresh. And so I knew that there was a lot of stuff down there that that I had to go through and just kind of get an idea of what was there. And there was a Anvil flight case for a piano, and I opened it up expecting that there would be some interesting things there, and there were belongings from my grandfather from when we cleaned out his apartment after he passed away, and some acetates and things. But there was this green vinyl suitcase that had just this huge amount of reel-to-reel tapes that were all kind of twisted and spaghettied together, and I took the suitcase down to a local studio here, and they went through it meticulously and then put it all on CD and uncovered just, you know, over 100 songs.
Wow. Now, how did you go about deciding what to do? Because a number of these are songs we know, but I've listened to these, and it's sometimes hard to tell whether these are demos or alternate versions or what are they. For instance, to me, it sounds like an earlier version of Werewolves of London. Where's that from?
Yeah, everything on here you would pretty much consider a demo because it wasn't... That was recorded, I think, in 74, 73.
Hmm.
So it wasn't as if... I've heard, actually, tapes from the Warner Brothers vaults of alternative versions of songs, and, you know, where they sound almost like the final version, but there's just a little bit of a twist on them. But this was something that was considered a demo, and everything here was pretty much either to sell the song or get a record contract and... or just do like a home demo recording of it to listen back and see if he was happy with the lyrics and the performance and just get the song ironed out, as it were.
Hmm. Well, this one people will note is a little bit different version. So let's just listen to this version of perhaps to a lot of people, Warren Zevon's best known tune, Werewolves of London.
Alas, poor Yorick, I knew him well. Menu in his hand. He's walking down the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for a place called Lee Ho Folks. Gonna get himself a big dish of beef chow mein. Werewolves of London. You better not let him in. Little old lady got mutilated late last night. Werewolves of London again. He's a hairy-handed gent who ran amok in Kent. And lately has been overhyped in Mayfair. You better stay away from him. He'll rip your lungs out, Jim. It's Taylor. Werewolves of London.
That's one of the preludes, rare and unreleased recordings of Warren Zevon, and we're talking with his son, Jordan, who was responsible for producing this album, is, of course, producing The Wind and so much more. I want to talk more about the some of the reissues that are coming out. It's just, if you are any kind of a Warren Zevon fan, there's just so much fabulous, fabulous things happening right now. A couple of the things on here, I wanted to find out about the Rosarita Beach Cafe, because it's interesting how you've placed it next to Desperados Under the Eaves, because it seems lyrically to have connection there, and I'm wondering what's the origin of that song.
The origin of Desperados is just from his time at these shoddy motels trying to work out his career and get things off the ground. And I think it was just a pretty difficult time in his life. And you know, that's where some of your best work comes out of. So I think that's where... But it's a very real song. It's a very autobiographical song. It's not. It's certainly not some a made up character. That was what his life was at the time. Well, I think a lot of his earlier material, as opposed to the latter material, was very autobiographical.
Well, let's hear that song, which I guess is the motel in question would be the Tropicana, right? Even though he doesn't name it that way.
Well, I thought it was the Tropicana, but I'm being told that there might have been, because I know he spent a lot of time there, but there actually was a Hollywood Hawaiian Hotel, which apparently was a really lovely place where he'd have to, you know, step over drug addicts and things like that to get to his room. So I think maybe as a child I was spared visiting that particular place. But the Tropicana was another place where he stayed a lot. I guess L.A. had a big Hawaiian hotel theme at the time.
This is the Rosarita Beach Cafe.
With Tennessee sour mash, whiskey on my breath, Rosalie, Susie, and Lucy on my mind. I drove my old car down the dusty streets of this old border town, but I never thought I'd get stuck here such a long, long time. I got $1 million bill, and they can't change it. They won't let me leave until my tab is paid. So I might as well settle down, yes, and buy the house another round. Send my mail to the Rosarita Beach Cafe.
The Rosarita Beach Cafe, one of the songs found and put on Preludes, rare and unreleased recordings. And Jordan Zeman, you were talking about songs coming out of his life. How does that relate to an earlier song? I guess one of his first songs, Carmelita.
Well, I think that his story wasn't that it is a fictional story, but at the same time, it draws from places that he'd lived and places that he'd been to. And I've seen pictures, and it might even still be there, the Pioneer Chicken Stand. And that was one of the times where it was a work of fiction, but still kind of loosely based around his environment, which is why he got the moniker of the LA singer-songwriter, because so much of his work was based on his surroundings, which was Los Angeles.
I hear mariachi static on my radio, and the tubes, they glow in the dark. And I'm there with her in Ensenada, and I'm here in Echo Park. Carmelita, hold me tight, oh, I think I'm sinking down. And I'm all strung out on heroin on the outskirts of town. I've been sitting here playing solitaire with my pearl-handled deck. The county won't give me no more methadone, and they cut off your welfare check. Carmelita, hold me tight, oh, I think I'm sinking down. And I'm all strung out on heroin on the outskirts of town.
That's Carmelita, one of the newly released versions of this from rare and unreleased recordings, found in a green suitcase.
A green vinyl suitcase in a valley storage area.
One of the other things you've been responsible for is getting some of the albums that were not on CD reissued in just fine form, plus bonus tracks, which are a little bit different than what we've been listening to from the Preludes. I assume these are all tracks that happened at the same, close to the time of the recordings. I'm talking about the Envoy album, which is now out on CD, and Stand in the Fire, as well as Excitable Boy. But the Envoy and Stand in the Fire, the live album, were not available on CD, right?
No, they were never available on CD, which was just a real shame, and it was really a kind of a happy moment for me, because I mean, the Dad's Fans trade, there's a bulletin board on his website and they trade live recordings and things like that, and I even said with those records, if you want to trade them because you can't buy them, go right ahead. But then you go on eBay and somebody's selling the very rare Stand in the Fire CD for $30. And I know it's just some jamoke with the cassette that he recorded a CD off of, and he's trying to charge people $30 for it. And that's the part that would really bother me. I didn't mind anything else, but just to take advantage of the people that supported Dad's career was really frustrating. So I was really happy to get those out there. And Stand in the Fire has gotten a great reaction, and I think people don't remember or realize just what a great live record that is. It's extremely, extremely live. I mean, it's just a very energetic performance that was well recorded, and the band and everything was playing great. And I remember the show, and the shows were fabulous. So,
well, this is one of the bonus tracks from the now on CD version of Stand in the Fire, Warren Zevon's concert recorded live at the Roxy, and this is a version of Johnny Strikes Up the Band. Johnny Strikes Up the Band from Warren Zevon's Stand in the Fire, now available thanks to the folks at Rhino on CD. And it's great to be able to have this, and also great to have the extra tracks, too. And there's a lot of attention right now on Warren's life because Crystal Zevon, who's not your mother, your mother passed away around the shortly after Warren did?
About 8 months after of breast cancer.
I don't think people understand what a year that must have been for you. Was it good to have the work there to stay focused?
Yes, extremely. Yeah. It was good to have the work there, and you know, you go through the stages and the denial and everything else, and so even with something like the speech at the Grammys was something that maybe beforehand I would have been terrified of, but I was just in that mode of, you know, if, as long as it's not death, then what is there to be afraid of? So I was able to kind of face it pretty boldly, but who knows? If I had to do it again tomorrow, maybe I'd be a quivering mess.
Well, Crystal Zevon has put together this oral history of your dad called I'll Sleep When I'm Dead, The Dirty Life and Times of Warren Zevon, and it is your dad, all the genius, all the downside, everything he went through, and I'm curious as to your reaction to reading the whole book.
Well, I can't tell you my reaction to reading the whole book because it is so it's so raw and real that it's just, you know, it's just kind of tough. And I'm doing some touring and other things like that, and I'm sure I'll kind of take a chapter at a time and go through it, but I think that's probably the other thing that's going to make it so engaging for people to read is that it's not a glossed over version. It's not a movie of the week version of his life, but it's a very real telling of his life. And so, yeah, it's been a little emotional for me. So
our thanks to Jordan Zevon for talking with us. That album he's put together lovingly is called Preludes. And it's interesting to hear the alternate versions of Warren Zevon tunes we all know. I interviewed Warren Zevon a couple of times on the World Cafe, the last time in the year 2000 when his album Life Will Kill You came out. That was 3 years before his death. The album was filled with references to mortality and illness, and I asked Warren about it.
A lot of these songs are there's a realization of aging in this album. Well, Life Will Kill You, after you kind of write that, you kind of said it all. Don't Let Us Get Sick, which is kind of a benediction to the record in a way.
Yeah, I think it is in a way. I suppose it's about the realization. The realization of aging doesn't bother me in the least. But I'm lucky. I've had kids most of my life, so I've always been an old guy. The realization of aging doesn't bother me. The realization of death is, on the other hand, something that you want to kind of work out. Although maybe we're not going to realize it when it happens, and that'll be merry.
Can you do that, Don't Let Us Get Sick?
Sick, don't let us get old, don't let us get stupid, all right, just make us be brave, make us play nice, let us be together tonight. On fire when I walked to the mill to take up the slack in the line. I thought of my friends and the troubles they've had to keep me from thinking of mine. Don't let us get sick, don't let us get old. Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave, make us play nice. Let us be together tonight. Face and it smiles on the lake and causes the ripples in time. I'm lucky to be here with someone I like who maketh my spirit to shine. Don't let us get sick, don't let us get old, don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave, make us play nice. Let us be together tonight. Don't let us get sick, don't let us get old. Don't let us get stupid, all right. Just make us be brave, make us play nice, let us be together tonight.
Don't Let Us Get Sick. Wow, that is the song that finished off Warren Zevon's 2000 album, Life Will Kill You, and that is a live version recorded for us here at the World Cafe. Again, our thanks to Jordan Zevon and to Crystal Zevon for joining us today on the show. Support for the World Cafe comes from NPR stations and Subaru. With the safety and performance of all-wheel drive on every vehicle, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Additional support for the World Cafe is provided by the members of the World Cafe affiliates nationwide. The show is produced at WXPN from the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. I'm David Dye. This is the World Cafe.